I don't think I'm a very good natural writer. I don't think I was born with that, with very much ability at all. I think I've had to learn almost everything I know about it.
Hello, and welcome to the second podcast in a series of specially commissioned recordings brought to you by Thresholds, the online international short story forum hosted by the University of Chichester, who have joined forces this year with Small Wonder, the Short Story Festival, to record four special discussions that we're calling Short Story Masterclass. My name's Steve Wasserman, and in this podcast you're about to hear, I talk with the freely cussing, fruitfully contemplating Joe O'Connor about the narrative taximeter in readers' heads, supercharging your language, subjoycean epiphanies, using the deep structures of life in order to contain a story, getting dialogue right, and how to know when your writing ain't as good as it should be. Take it away, Joe.
Dublin, 2007. 2 decades or more had passed since I'd seen him, but here he was in the ample flesh, through the glinting window of an estate agency on Fownes Street, a hallucination in shirt sleeves and crumpled suit trousers, £50 heavier and just about bald, but it was him right enough. I almost wanted to keep walking. Holy Christ. So Ruth had been right that time. Eddie Virago, back in Dublin, flogging flats for a living. He grinned and mouthed my name as he clocked me through the window, but he didn't look delighted to see me. "How's tricks?" I asked, when he came out and shook hands. "State of you," he beamed. "You're gone Victor Mature." Eddie was the kind of guy I used to try and latch on to back in my early days in London. Hip, facetious, indifferent to convention. He'd shape into the bunch of grapes in his shabby denim jacket, in his tattered leather jeans and Sid Vicious t-shirt, his brothel creepers, so utterly grubby it was impossible to picture them having once been clean. Saturday nights, the place would be heaving with yuppie Irish. I suppose it was a home away from home. Posters of Killarney cottages and Michael Collins and Joyce, agricultural tackle hanging on the walls, a regiment of Southside Dublin emigres storming the bar. One glance from Eddie and his pint would be put up. Not even a glance, the raising of an eyebrow. There was gossip in my crowd that he managed a band, that they'd signed to one of the majors and were about to record an album. I don't know if it was true, but he never dampened the talk. He'd just smile this unassuming grin. Think Bill Clinton, only with cheekbones, you're not far off. And say he couldn't go into the details. For contractual reasons, man, you know how it is. I don't know that I ever talked to Eddie for longer than a few minutes. He was always just around, chewing it with some wannabe model, slumped against the brickwork like he was propping it up. To be honest, I thought myself too uncool for him to like me. You're 21 in London, you want everyone to like you. I'd spent 2 years after the Leaving Cert studying to be a Jesuit, and even after I'd jacked it in, I still felt people saw me as a priest. They'd make a point of watching their language, infuriating behaviour like that. They'd tell me their sins when they had a few jars on them, their sexual misdemeanours, their secret admiration for Mrs. Thatcher. Eddie never confessed, and that was inspirational. He'd take you on your terms. He didn't judge. You'd see him at gigs, parties, clubs. He'd even pitch up at the odd poetry reading, but he rarely stayed to the end. I was kicking around with this girl who did the London publicity for U2, and one time she got us tickets for a Dylan gig at the Hammersmith Odeon. At the backstage party afterwards, there was old Eddie, in the roped-off area for VIPs, one arm around the edge, the other around Tom Paulin, flicking his fag ash into a champagne flute held by a one-time member of Bananarama. A face like a Michelangelo, someone once said of Eddie, and a neck like a jockey's bollocks. It was rumoured around the pubs that he had an on-off girlfriend who was from small town Donegal and not much of a rock chick, but that didn't seem likely, and I certainly didn't ask him. He was one of those Irish males you don't question, the type with an ectoplasm of elusiveness around him. Often, if you were jarred, you'd have the impression of him looking out at you from inside his head through this swirling fog of ambiguity. Eddie Virago, the High King of Cagey, wearing his Mohican like a crown.
Wonderful, thank you.
strange guy.
Well, he is your he's kind of your Falstaff, Eddie, isn't he? I mean, it seems he's your Falstaff, but he's also your Harry Rabbit Angstrom, isn't it? Because you keep on returning to
him. I do, yes, now and again. He's the hero of my first few short stories that I ever wrote, or certainly that I ever had published. And he is the anti-hero, more precisely, of my first novel, which is called Cowboys and Indians, which documents Eddie's leaving his hometown of Dublin in the 1980s to go to London and become a rock star. And he fails to do that, but he has some fun along the way. And so I suppose he's a character that I've come back to throughout my career in writing. Mm. I find every 10 years or so, as I age myself, I want to have a look at what Eddie is doing. You know, when I first wrote about him, he was the same age as me. And so perhaps my way of checking in on myself is checking in on him, the fraud.
Mm. Now, in that first section you read for us, particularly the first paragraph, we get a lot of information about the character, his relationship to the narrator. I mean, you're really packing it all in into that kind of narrative suitcase. Is that something you're more conscious of doing when you're writing a short story as opposed to a novel, of just making each sentence really kind of work for its money?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think you're very aware when you're writing a short story that there's a kind of taxi meter running, and the reader is really getting ready to switch off, and you want to grab the reader pretty much as quickly as you can, and to supercharge the language, not just with information, but with a sense of the tone or tones in which the rest of the story is going to be told. I mean, a short story to me, it's much more like writing poetry than it is like writing a novel. I think they come from totally different bits of the brain or the imagination. And I mean, somebody once said that poetry is language charged with meaning to the greatest possible intensity. Leavis, I think, said that. And to me, that's what a short story is. You know, every single sentence has to count, and you need to be really ruthless editing a short story. I mean, the beauty of the novel as a form is that it allows for that greater expansiveness. And I think you probably should feel, you are entitled to feel as a reader at the end of a novel, that you know pretty much everything about the person that you've been reading about. A short story, I think, is trying to do a different thing, or certainly mine are. I'm often trying to leave the reader with a question or a series of questions rather than a series of answers, you know, in a story. I think the form has a kind of subtlety that's more to do with the poem or the song than it has to do with the novel.
And certainly in this story, you know, we're kind of checking in, as you were saying, we're checking in with this character, which it seems like the sort of short story is almost made, designed beautifully to do. But that could also be a criticism of the short story as well, couldn't it? That we check in with these characters, we get a snapshot of their lives, and then we check out. And that's sort of intrinsically unsatisfying
in
a way.
Well, that's the problem with a lot of short stories, that you sometimes feel the short story has taken advice of the kind that I've just given and has done nothing else. I mean, a lot of short stories written by that group of writers called the Dirty Realists, I suppose, Raymond Carver and Richard Ford and Tobias Wolff, I mean, their stories are all wonderful. But a lot of stories by their imitators, you sort of feel, okay, so there's a character in the room, you don't know anything about him, he goes to the window, he looks out, he describes the weather, a car drives up the snow-filled street towards him, the end. And you sort of feel, well, come on, like, you give me a little bit more than that, you know, it can't all be sub-Joycean epiphanies and, you know, unspoken emotions and unvoiced realities. Otherwise, I think we feel we're being had. You know, I hate tricks in a piece of fiction, I suppose. You know, Carver said about one of his own teachers, in short story writing, that he used to drum it into his students. There should be no cheap tricks, no cheap tricks. And Carver said, I would abbreviate it. There should be no tricks at all. Mm-hmm. And that every short story writer should have that written on a 3x5 postcard over their desk, because it is a form that's open to all sorts of nonsense and a sort of insubstantiality that makes the short story, when it's done badly, really unsatisfying. Mm-hmm. So you have to know what you're doing. You have to know why it is a story. You have to know why you chose that particular form and what it is in the relationship between these characters that you're zeroing in on, and you know why it isn't a chapter in a novel. Mm. You know.
Now, talking of Carver's commandments, you have, well, I found a similar list, sort of the O'Connor Ten Commandments.
Well, yeah. I think there are 13 of them.
Floating around. The one I found was. Were that? I think the one I found was 10. They were definitely going for the written on stone commandments of the 10. And there's a few of those there that I thought were really interesting in terms of thinking about this story. I mean, for example, one thing that you talk about in that 10 is the importance of structuring and setting up milestones in the story for the reader, a sort of a roadmap so the reader doesn't get lost in the story. And I suppose I was wondering specifically in terms of this story, which is essentially a conversation. Mm. Were you conscious of doing that? What are the sort of the some of the are there milestones, or is it more kind of free flowing because it is a conversation? A conversation goes all over the place, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, what the story is trying to achieve is the texture of a spontaneous conversation that might happen between two men in a pub. And of course, if you were foolish enough to write down a transcript of the actual conversation of two men talking in a pub, it would be unreadable and you just wouldn't have much interest. So it's one of the things Joyce teaches us is how to pull off that particular little bit of magic. Not that I compare my story to his in terms of their success. But yes, the story has a kind of roadmap, a hidden roadmap, which is it's structured around a night out. So it's two people meeting. Will we go for a night out? Will we not? If we're going to, well, then we have to prepare for it. I have to go and put money in the parking meter for my car. So you use that little journey to begin to get information in. Then we get to the car. It's not just going to be any old car. I'm going to use this car to boast. Have you seen my wonderful car? Have you seen that my car is much nicer than yours? Have you seen that there's a baby seat in the back? So these are my children. So already, before the evening has really kicked off, our poor narrator is being put under the heel by this guy. So then we go to the trendy bar where nobody can get served, but this guy can. Then this guy starts buying the drinks. If you're going to buy all the drinks all night, well then, you know, you've got lots of money. And only then, really, when our poor fellow who's experiencing all of this is already almost crushed, only then does the actual boasting start. And it's punctuated with memories, as it would be, since it's a conversation between two old friends, just as a way of easing the pressure. You know, you can come into their memories about gigs they went to and friends that they had and love affairs that didn't work out.
Quite sort of visual, the way you've plotted it out, a little bit like a film, in a way. I could imagine, the way you were talking about these characters, I could imagine a scene in a film.
It's more like a night out,
yeah.
Really, to me. I mean, all of our lives are full of structures every day. This interview has a structure. We didn't just turn up and start to chat. You thought about it in advance, and I probably thought a bit in advance of what I was going to say. Going to work has a structure. Going home in the evening has a structure. Falling in love has a structure. You know, everything does, and you really need to find that for a short story to work.
You know. So that's something you consciously would think of, those kind of deep structures.
Yes, I do,
What is the deep structure of this, and how can I use that to contain the story?
Yes, absolutely. Or you might think, another way of putting it, I suppose, is you might think of it as being like a piece of music. a piece of classical music or a piece of jazz that sort of states a theme at the beginning and maybe repeats the theme in a different key. You go into a minor key sometimes, so it becomes genuinely sad. You might, at a later point in the story, go into a key that's full of sevenths, you know, so it's very exciting, it's very jazzy and very electric. And this particular story, I suppose the aim is that it does move through a number of keys because it's trying to embody an evening where people are drinking, you know. So at the start of the story, the start of the evening, the prose is quite precise, and the two old friends haven't met in a while, and the introduction, although it's lighthearted, is quite formal, as though the author is introducing the characters to you, as you said, giving you quite a lot of information about them. Then we go to the bar and they start drinking, and it becomes very full of one-liners, very, I hope, snappy at that point. You know, here's my stand-up routine that I've learned about myself. The narrator says he's talking about himself in the third person, as though he's learnt it all off by heart. And there are paragraphs where kind of every line is trying to be a joke. You know, he's talking about his relationship with his former wife. You know, it started as the relationship he'd always yearned for. It had ended as the emotional equivalent of a groin strain. They watched the soaps like zombies. Blah, blah, blah. I mean, I don't have it in my head.
One of my favourite lines is right at the end, which is sort of this, I suppose, you know, when they're fully tanked up, the kind of slurring, as you were saying, passive-aggressive slur, where he says, "Keep in touch, you skinny fucking pussy-whipped Chiswick-dwelling prick."
Yep.
That is just...
Well, it's that, that's...
I mean, it's a very... It's a funny, funny story.
Yeah.
And the dialogue zing.
I never fall out with my editor, who I love, the great man, Jeff Mulligan. But in the original text, every time Eddie says, "fuck off," there's a confusion early in the story about who's married to who. Eddie makes a sort of derogatory sexist remark about this girl he used to know back in London, and it turns out the narrator is married to her. So he says this, and Eddie says, "fuck off." And the narrator says, "No, I really am." And Eddie says, "fuck off, you fucking bollocks, before I beat you through that wall." And in the original text I'd written, I had forgotten how some Irish men talk to each other. And my editor said, "No, just take that out, because that's how all men talk to each other to some degree." Yeah. So I took it out. Yeah, so it's that sort of mock peacock display of assertiveness in the language. Men seem to be able to tell each other to go fuck yourself as a form of affection. It's weird. Mm. You never, ever hear women doing that. Mm. But yeah, it was just to sort of, as the evening gets a bit more wild, as you say, to fill it with these insults.
It's not just this story. There's a lot of dialogue in all of the stories, and you do seem to sort of revel, actually, in the writing of the dialogue.
Yeah.
Now, I know, and I'm sure other people listening will know, that you started off, you did, and or perhaps not started off, I'm not sure exactly the chronology of it, but you did a screenwriting master's at some point, some stage. Are there things that you learnt doing that you've taken with you into short stories? I mean, particularly about writing good dialogue, which is a really quite a tough thing, I think, for a lot of short story writers to do and to pull off.
Well, writing dialogue is just the hardest thing, because we all think we know how to do it.
Yeah. We talk, we should be able to write.
We talk and we recognise a funny or a very powerful line of dialogue when we hear it on the bus or on the tube, and we think that's great. But when you write it down, it sometimes isn't great. And the person who taught me, or the person I'm still trying to learn from about dialogue is Joyce. Nobody has ever written greater dialogue than Joyce, because he's able to negotiate that very perilous journey through the swamp of the chronicler on the one hand and the artist on the other. Joyce is able to take idiomatic speech and slang and strange metaphor and turn it into beauty. I mean, you read pages and pages of his dialogue from very ordinary people who haven't necessarily had, you know, a massive education or read lots of literary novels, and it just begins to sing. It just begins to come to life, and there's something in you that just rejoices at the nuance and the zest and the juiciness of popular speech. And I always tell my own students whenever I teach writing, if you want to learn dialogue, he's the man. You just go back to him always. I mean, the Dublin and London habit in speech of dropping the final G in a verb, I was walking, I was fighting, I was going for a drink, he never does. He never tries to sort of make it the transcript of a tape recording. He understands that if you render dialogue phonetically, you're demeaning the character. You only render dialogue phonetically when you think you are a bit better than the person you're writing about. He never does that. His approach is completely the opposite. He thinks that everyday speech is as capable of poetry and meaning and nuance as, you know, the work of the Greek masters is, and that's who you go back to, and that's who so many people went back to. There couldn't be Carver or Ford if there hadn't been Joyce. You know, I think of him as, he's kind of the way the Rolling Stones went back to Muddy Waters. You know, there couldn't have been the Rolling Stones if there hadn't been Muddy Waters. I'm glad there was the Stones, I love them, but they weren't muddy, you know, and I think everybody who wants to write dialogue should go back to Joyce all the time.
So if we're trying to get that kind of poetry of the demotic, I'm just wondering, just in terms of the kind of almost the mechanics, the nuts and bolts of when you're writing it, what are you doing? Are you doing all the voices in that kind of Dickensian way? You know, it does all the voices. Are you, when you're sitting writing it, because you're not going out onto streets transcribing what people say, or you might be doing that as well.
No, I don't think you're doing that. I mean, I do, you know, I think you have to have a good ear and you have to develop that. And if somebody says something funny within your hearing, I think you should remember it. But it's much more to do with rhythm, I think. It's just practice. You write it down and you get up at the end of a session of writing and you walk up and down your office or your room and you read it aloud. And if you can read it aloud without stammering, then I think you're close to it being okay. And conversely, if you think you've written wonderful lines of Tarantino-like electricity, but you can't read them aloud, then there's something wrong with them.
And you've mentioned music a number of times so far in our chat, and I absolutely agree with you. I often think of a short story collection as being a little bit like an album.
Yeah.
And so certain stories in that album are kind of, you know, the hit singles in a way, I suppose, that's kind of killer tracks, and the others all...
Yeah, the padding.
I wasn't going to use that word, but the others all lend variety and some colour to it. But there are certain tracks on any album that are those kind of killer tracks. Yeah. So the question is, what is, for you, what would you say is do you see as kind of a killer track on this album, and what makes it a killer?
The surprising thing about albums is that a great album changes as you change, as you age. The track that you didn't necessarily like when you were 15, you now love, you know. It's very, very few albums are unchanging in that way, you know. And, you know, you've got Abbey Road by the Beatles, but you've also got the White Album, which is a slightly more baggy creature. But songs that I didn't like when I heard the White Album first, I now love.
I mean, that brings us, I think, to another interesting O'Connor commandment. You don't mind me calling them commandments, do you?
I sort of do.
Well, they are called tips. They are called tips. But there's something about that alliteration. It's the double C's, you see, that I like.
No, they're really... They're mistakes that I made. You know, they're things that I wish that someone had told me. And and so I'm telling you now.
They are fantastic. And the one I really like, just kind of on the back of what you were saying there, is... In fact, it's the one where you say, if I have one single commandment, know who it's for.
Yeah.
And I find that really fascinating, because so often you hear writers saying things like, you know, oh, I'm just writing for myself, I don't care, you know, who the reader is, blah, 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 blah. I mean, who do you have in mind? Who do you know or hope that these stories are for? when you write them?
Oh, well, they're certainly for somebody. I don't write to express myself. I have very little interest in myself, to be honest. And the kind of writing that is done in order to sort of put, to attach adjectives to private neurosis, I hope people find it very enriching and therapeutic to do, but it certainly doesn't interest me. I suppose I have a sort of composite ideal reader, and he or she is made up of, you know, a number of actual people I know, a number of other readers, people from my own life, and people who have written to me about my books over the years, and people who have disliked my books over the years, who I would like to win over. I suppose that skeptical, hard to impress front row of an audience in a Glasgow comedy club, you know, sitting there with their arms folded saying, go on then if you're so fucking funny. That would be part of my... I think my ideal reader is quite a tough guy, you know, or quite a tough lady.
Yeah, which I think brings us, I suppose, to this, to one of my perennial questions.
Go on then, with your hardy perennials.
The hardy perennials. Which is about risk. And that is, you know, to what extent when you're writing your stories are you aware of, or even attempting to take on a bit more than you're comfortable with, taking risks, sort of driving off-road without a map?
I don't think I'm a very good natural writer. I don't think I was born with that, with very much ability at all. I think I've had to learn almost everything I know about it, and I find it very hard. I still find writing very hard. I love doing it, and those moments that you get it right, you know, there's nothing like that. But you get it wrong, or I get it wrong a lot of the time, and for every kind of 1,000 words I write, you know, on average I probably keep 100 of them. So the whole thing is risky.
And how do you know when you've got it wrong?
You get a feeling in your heart of hearts that you've read this before, or that this is sentimental, or you're telling the reader how to feel. You're breaking all of the oldest rules that, you know, we've had since Chekhov. You know, you're telling, not showing. You know, you want to actually be in the story yourself. You want to go around to the house of every reader and read it to them. All of those things. It's all risk-taking. Why does anybody feel they have anything worth saying? You know, do you live in a world where we're told all the great writers have been already? There only ever were 36 stories anyway. And nobody reads, and the novel is dead, and reading is dead, and, but yet you find that you open a notebook and you start writing sentences down. I mean, it's quite a risky thing to do. It's not coal mining, you know, but it's you're doing something that you're not sure will have any purpose at all, and you don't know why. I mean, that's quite risky in itself. And then I suppose you just, that you want to stretch, you know, you want to get better. You want to be as good a writer as you can be. I mean, when I look back now on my early books, I want to read them through barred fingers like that, vomiting with shame, you know, but at the time they were the best that I could do, but they're not now, you know. So that's a risk. The risk that you keep going and you do something that you think is your best, but it's not really. And then you start to do what is your best. And then you come over the peak of the mountain and you begin the gentle, gracious descent into your final irrelevance and mediocrity, you know? So that's a risk too.
Well, if anything, this conversation proves that we're nowhere near that descent yet in terms of O'Connor's fire in his fiction belly. Hope you enjoyed that as much as we did, and do come back for the next one. If you haven't already done so, you might want to check out all the other short story amazingness on the Thresholds website, as well as the Small Wonder Festival part of the net that can be found by simply typing Small Wonder into Google or any internet search engine of your choice. Cheerio.